There we go.
This is the beginning of topic 5 and 6. Just for those that are listening on the recording, I was just saying that the reading for this week, which is What is Life from the Systems View of Life, is just a reading. I'm not going to be covering that in class. It's there really as a background for this reading from Hans Jonas, which is the core of what we're going to be looking at this period of the course, where every now and then before class I get a kind of a preparatory stream of consciousness about, you know, what should I say in this class. And often I have to say it's Maria who I'm talking to. You've become a bit of a figure for me. So, but now I feel like I have made it clear enough why we're doing this? Why are we going into this history of science? Because it's not a historical picking up facts about the history of science. It's to do, if I can put it in a Jungian way, because I've been, you know, looking at Jung, it's to do with the myth that we're living at the moment. So it's not even that, you know, because I feel like if you went into science departments and asked scientists what they think, you'd get a lot of different opinions, not many of them would say that they're card-carrying scientific materialists. They're aware of the problems of scientific materialism, but some will, some won't. But you won't get a uniform opinion. And if you go out in the street and ask someone if they're a scientific materialist, they'll say, "I don't even know what that is." But the reason we're looking at this is because, well, it's not that this is something that's conscious necessarily, but it's the background. Way
Hello.
More. It's the background myth, which for us is quite interesting, because science doesn't recognise itself as a myth. Doesn't think of itself as a myth. It thinks of itself as, in Greek terms, as the logos, as the opposite of a myth. And I guess part of what this part of the course is about is to say, no, it's a kind of myth, even though it's a sort of an anti-myth. But even being an anti-myth, it's our background understanding of why we're here and what we're doing on Earth, that our culture has. And in a way, it's like an awful lot of what we're looking at here. It's not immediately obvious to us because we can't explicate it.
I think there are plenty, culturally, there are plenty of myths about science, usually in the form of what happened, you know, science going terribly wrong, like Frankenstein and all the science fiction stuff.
Yes.
Usually contains an anti, you know, a sort of a myth of science, if you like. Science is a monster.
Yes. But I'm saying collectively, the myth of our culture has a creation myth. It's the Big Bang. Yes? And it has an answer to the old question that the Greeks asked. You know, what is the world? What does it consist of? What is it? What are the ultimate constituents of being? And the ultimate constituents of being is material stuff. That's our myth. And then when we want to explain, well, where did life come from? How did things? There's the Big Bang. Then what happened? You know, what guided us? Where did humanity come from? And our myth is the theory of evolution. That's our background myth. And you might say, well, there's a lot of people that don't believe it, don't even understand it, wouldn't be able to explicate natural selection, and wouldn't know about random mutation and all the rest of it. But it's still operative at a deep level, because it's almost in a negative way, because it's destroyed the former myth. The former myth of creation, the former myth that there was an intelligent agency, whom we called God, that was behind our being here and guaranteed our sense of what's right and what's wrong, and had some purpose in mind for our existence. The sense of, that we're living in a scientific myth is the sense that the scientific myth has destroyed that and left us with a kind of nothing, an absence of that. And in the in that absence, if you interrogate science, then that's what you'll find is what I'm showing you. You'll find we've got a materialistic understanding of how the universe evolved, which is essentially rational and mathematical. And our civilization is, it's hard to say that it's rational. Oh, hello, Alex. It's hard to say that we're rational because we do so many irrational things. But essentially, another way of looking at our acceptance of the idea of evolution in a deep way is the way that we...
Sorry.
is that it deeply informs our social relations. And there's a deep foundation and connection between scientific materialism and capitalism, because scientific materialism flattens every being. This is a Heideggerian term. It flattens being and says all being is basically material stuff, which lays the ground for the idea that everything is a commodity that can be traded and valued by a number. And that number, of course, is currency. Yeah, so there's a deep parallel between how we operate with commodity and money, which is basically that our entire commercial culture says, at a certain level, everything's for sale and nothing is sacred. Now, how did it get to everything's for sale and nothing is sacred? It's deeply connected with scientific materialism. And at the same time, the raison d'etre, the reason for, if you were looking for a purpose, the purpose of our culture, if you're trying to say, well, what is the purpose of our culture hidden in it somewhere? It's this, because I'm saying there's a myth operating here. It's the myth of progress. The idea, somehow or other, that if we keep going the way that we're going, we might not know where we're going, we might not know why we're here, but our iPhones are getting better. Yes? We've got the internet. We didn't used to have the internet. But our technology is continuously evolving and in many ways demonstrably getting better. Now, for a long time, we could also say our living standards were getting better, at least in the developed West, and there was a progress in that. There was material progress. And in a sense, our reason for being here is material progress. And if material progress starts to falter, you will notice that our civilization, our societies start to fall apart, as in fact starts to happen with austerity. You can see the beginnings of, if you don't get material progress, it all starts to split up again. Because that's... What's the reason? We're not here for the glory of God. We're not here to become more conscious as a culture. What are we here for? We're here to become better off. We're here, aren't we? On the basis of technological progress. And what is the basis of technological progress? It's scientific materialism. Now I'm just trying to once again give you the bigger picture of why this is so important. Because My endeavour is to bring scientific materialism up into consciousness to examine it. Because in a way, the way that we live isn't that scientific materialism is a myth. It's that science has shown us that this is the way things are. There isn't a man in the moon. There isn't a god pulling the sun across the sky. A Father God in the sky who loves us. How could there be a Father God in the sky who loves us if there was the First and Second World Wars. I mean, that was another... It's not just scientific materialism, it's other... There are other factors in history that have expunged that idea from our collective... And our collective myth is a background understanding in which we live that is extremely hard to discern unless you... It's like all of these things, unless you... have known another culture. It's getting a bit hot in here, isn't it? Yeah, now we've got all the bodies.
Yeah.
See, I was reminded...
Open the window.
You know, in the early days... I'll just turn this off, I think. In the early days of my personal biography, if you like, and Nicolette's, we were both members of a cult. Yeah. I think that's what it... We didn't think it was a cult, but yeah, it was a cult. And that was a direct experience for me of living with a group of people who lived according to another myth. And suddenly you see... It's only by doing that that you suddenly see that everyone else is living a different myth. Yes, but unconsciously. It's almost... And the sense I got a lot from that. But one of them was the extraordinary isolation that everyone lives in. You know, as soon as you join together with a group of people who have a common purpose, I mean, think people get this from joining the army, or maybe even City Clean, on a good day.
Yeah, sense of camaraderie.
Yeah, yeah. You start getting it when groups of people get together with a shared purpose. Yeah. You start to realise that there's a whole other way of living here. That the way that we live in our culture is a completely fragmented way of life because there's no overarching unifying purpose in it all. It's just a kind of a scrabble for goods, isn't it?
In a supermarket.
Yes. Yeah. That's putting it in a horrible way. I mean, but as individuals, we each have to try and scrape together some sense of meaning out of a desert, really, don't we? And that's not to say that we don't. And you can get meaning out of relationship, and in a way, you can create your own world in your own life. But I find I do this against the background of another kind of social world that in some sense, in historical terms, it's unusual. It's hard for us, I think, to get a sense of how it must have been. I got a little bit of this in my own life, to have lived in a civilization where everybody didn't believe intellectually, but felt that there was a unity of a culture within a religion that everybody shared, not... Because when you have a religion now, you're kind of in a cult. Catholicism is now a kind of a cult because it stands against this bigger myth in which everybody is born now. And in a way, I mean, that's not to say that there aren't pockets of Catholicism in cultures across the world, but I'm thinking of the developed... Yes. Hello. I think we've changed rooms. So this is philosophy of consciousness.
Ali is there.
Joe's, for those of you on the tape, Joe's dealing with that.
Sorry, I thought it was 10:30.
Sorry, are you wanting to be in philosophy of consciousness?
I think so, yeah.
Are you sure?
It's been going for... It,
No.
I'm sorry.
No, this isn't... This isn't... Yes, we're 5 weeks in now.
Oh, no. This is...
Yes.
Sorry about that.
That's all right. I better throw that over.
This is me.
We can lock the door. Turn off the light.
I think there's going to be a lot of confusion now because...
Do you not think that alongside of this horribly bleak picture that you're painting, there's also, if you like, a myth of humanism? Because there's an awful lot of stuff around, we have a common... If you think about common purpose, the common purpose is to be able to exist together. And I often look at society in crowded places like Brighton and think, well, it's remarkably peaceful.
Yes.
Considering the stresses and the density
yes.
of the population. Because we all have a myth that it's in our interest not to go around punching people in the face because they jumped the queue in the bus at the bus stop or whatever. It is in our interest to at least coexist reasonably peacefully with each other. And there's an awful lot of this idea, I think, does underlie a lot of what you hear in the media and so forth, you know, these kind of celebrations of people doing wonderful things in the community and what have you. I think there's an awful lot of that going on as
yes,
well. To
yes.
counterbalance this kind of...
Well, I don't like to, you know, but it's Hobbes again. You know, it's a rational contract. We agree to help each other because the consequences of not doing that are too awful.
Yeah.
So it's not come out of any... I think underneath that, I agree. It's not all scientific materialism. There are many, many layers, and there are other myths that we've lived by, and the myth of Christianity actually is still operative. At a certain... It's almost like there are levels, and in Christianity, there is the brotherhood of man, if you like, there is an ideal of selflessness and of brotherly and sisterly love, and that's still there,
yeah.
isn't it? It expresses itself in some way in socialism.
I think
socialism is what Christianity has become, but if you see, it's become socialism, which is a kind of a rational. You know, socialism doesn't preach, although you know, it turns out Tony Blair became a Catholic, didn't he, at a certain point? Yes.
I think in Western Europe, this idea of socialism is so influenced by Christianity, while in the Eastern Bloc, behind the Iron Curtain back then.
Yes.
Socialist, you should be part of stone.
Yeah, but it was a Marxist materialism, wasn't it? That,
yeah.
Yes, whereas our socialism is a kind of a Christian, has a Christian influence in it. But do you see? It's once you take God away, I mean, Nietzsche was right. You know, God is dead. So socialism is Christianity with God taken out of it, but it's still got the impulse, which I don't think that we are. The material entities that science portrays us to be, and there are other dimensions in us. So I'm not saying it's all scientific materialism. I'm just, and especially for you, Maria, I'm pulling it up and I'm showing it to you in all its bleakness. And I don't want to ameliorate the picture. No, yes, because finally, it's something. That claims not to be a myth, it claims to be the truth, as all myths end up doing when they get, you know, a grip on a civilization. And you know, I guess one of the messages of this course is if it claims to be true, it isn't, and we can demonstrate that. And secondarily, not only that, it's come to a point now where it's counterproductive for our civilization. And to a certain extent, it was extremely productive, but in a very, you know, Darwinistic way. It's been extremely productive in terms of the scientific materialism of Western Europe has come to dominate the world. But it's spread across the globe. That is globalization, isn't it? So that's my background. I just want to remind everyone why we're looking at this. And in a way, I'm jumping across. I didn't finish the last lecture on Darwinism, but I think I said everything we needed to say about how we started off with Newton explaining how the behavior of the planets and of inanimate objects can be explained by mathematical laws of functional relationships. I was going to say cause and effect, but functional relationships is a better way of putting it. It's almost, it's, I mean, I guess the aim, in some sense, of this mathematical understanding is to say, what are the basic premises, the basic axioms that we need to have in place, on the basis of which we can generate the entire universe and everything in it. And, you know, the theory of everything, the idea of the Big Bang is the in cosmology is the beginning of that. Newton didn't have something as dramatic as that, but there was the beginning of the understanding that the sun and the planets really condensed out of a cloud of gas, which is pretty much accepted now. Way back then, that was already the picture. And the task of science, mathematical physics, was to say, well, can we explain everything? Did you manage to sort that out, Joe?
Well, just sorting it out.
Good, yeah. Because I thought we'd sorted everything out by being in here, but yes.
There's four classes going on.
Ah, four?
Yeah.
Because the main thing here is to be here in first.
Yes. But I take it you will have booked, because you've already started the course. There's a new course started. I think maybe they haven't booked.
Yes, they just...
In any case, there's four classes. There's three.
Well, there's a corridor.
Rooms. There's a corridor. They're going in the canteen.
Yes, I guess for the recording, I guess the problem here is we don't have that kind of admin. You know, we're starting to need admin staff to handle all of this and do the bookings, and soon we'll have to do timetabling. It's becoming a proper university, but you know, basically, yeah, that's right. I'm thinking of all the great secretaries I've known in my professional life, and they end up really. Running the show, they hold it all together. Everything, you know, and they remind you of everything you need to do, and you think, oh gosh, that's amazing. And of course, they're not getting paid properly for it. But anyway, let's not go into that. So let's start the lecture, because I'd like to just sink us back into Hans, because Nicolette, again, she feeds back to me. That she's finding Hans Jonas heavy going. I'm seeing a few nods. Yeah.
You remind me the history of one company that they were a multinational and they needed to open a branch in San Francisco. They were from Ireland. And then they started to find the person that could, the manager, to run the new branch in San Francisco. In America, and they were interviewing many people, and then one day the CEO saw the secretary, the administrative lady that was organizing everything, giving all the information,
yes.
And he thought maybe she can help us, and she was the new manager San Francisco, and she was running very well the new branch, because she knew everything. She knew how to organize the people, how to schedule everything.
Yes.
And he was realizing this, now about the ladies at the university.
Yeah, and it did turn out it always seemed to be women. It was always women.
It's the same where I work.
Yeah.
Lecturing in palliative care at the moment in our education centre at the hospice. And then we have three secretaries, all part-time, and they just keep the thing going just so smoothly. Everything is really very well
organised. I'm just going to switch off this one.
It's
getting hotter and hotter
here.
Yes, it's like a sauna.
I'm going to open
the
window in a minute. Let's not overdo it.
You can stay in the shower.
No, in a minute we'll be going, oh, it's really cold. So let's just let it... So that I'm just going to read this because I'd like to get you into, because I think Hans Jonas isn't saying anything that complex. But I'd like to get you into the. But he's saying something important. So, I mean, I guess if I'm going to put it in a nutshell, he's saying that in the Middle Ages there was this. Marriage between Christianity and Aristotle, or Aristotelian physics and Aristotelian philosophy that was wiped away in the scientific revolution. And he's saying that the summary of this lecture is something like this. When you come to study life, you come to realize that maybe it wasn't such a good idea to have thrown Aristotle away, or that medieval understanding was half right as well as half wrong. Yes, that we in our scientific materialism, we've come to an understanding that is only partial and is incapable of grasping what life is. That's the gist of the message, and it's the beginning of my sort of trying to show that you don't have to give up being scientific to criticize the myth of scientific materialism, because scientific materialism isn't science. What science is another question. But there's something in science that's essentially philosophical. Science is essentially philosophical, and always was at the beginning of the scientific revolution. It was considered natural philosophy.
Dogmatic.
But the impulse of science is, in some sense or other, to discover knowledge rather than opinion. That's the old Greek ideal. But and another way of looking at this course is to say, but in actual fact, that our science is like ourselves. There is still, it's a mixture of knowledge and opinion. But the opinion is become invisible. At least in the church had dogma. You believe this, and it's up front what you have to believe. In science, it's not so clear what science is asking you to believe, because it doesn't say this is a belief. It says, no, it's the way it is. But all systems have done that. All systems say, no, this isn't the belief, it's the way it is. Greek geometry considered the relations of unchanging figures and bodies. Simplistically put, circles, triangles, squares, rectangles, these idealized shapes. Remember back with Husserl, we were looking at the very extraordinary nature of the beginning of mathematical science was relating these idealized shapes to reality, which we take for granted now, but it was an extraordinary step to even start to think that way. And again, we were looking at how the idealized shapes and all of mathematics is only a model, and that we're one of the things that science does, our kind of science doesn't have to do this, is to take the model to be the reality, and take what the model models, which is our subjective experience of the world, to be a sort of something secondary that's generated by the model. And that's what I was just saying just now, you know, the model being the Big Bang, the laws of physics, the initial constants. That all generates the entire universe, and out of the entire universe, with the help of the theory of evolution, we can now explain how we were generated, and within us is generated this subjective experience that then looks back on the ultimately real universe. You know, that entire view is very seductive, and it's not entirely false. You see, you can't just say it's false. You have to look at it more carefully to see, well, is there a problem here? And we've started to look at the problem. One of the problems was that that entire understanding eliminated mind and consciousness from the picture at the very start. And then it has to, and these are the times we live in now, it then has to try and understand what consciousness is within a system that's already eliminated it as a way of being. Do you see? It's in a kind of an impossibility. This is one of the things Jonas is saying. It's an absurdity, if you're a materialist, to try and understand what consciousness is, because behind your back, when you were asleep, you'd already with Galileo specifically, expunged it. You said, I want to remove all subjectivity from my form of observation because it's only that way that we can become objective, in the sense that everybody can agree that if I get a foot ruler and I measure that being a foot, we all agree it's a foot. We can't agree about the quality of the colour that we're experiencing. We can't agree about the quality of the smell, the taste, the sound, all of that we can't be precise about. So we eliminate it. We can't be objective about it. But then we mistake the fact that we can be objective. We think that that means that it's real. But of course, your experience of colour is real. Your subjectivity is real. It's not an unreality. Just because you can't measure it. Do you see? It's terribly simple in a way. But it's something about humanity. It forgets the steps it made a few hundred years ago. You know, they just get ossified or solidified, and forgotten, and remain unexamined. Anyway, back to this. I'm having trouble just getting through one slide, so I'm going to try and force myself. Yes. Now, something happened with modern science in that it leapt over these shapes to this idea of what are the basic axioms that we need to propose in order to generate. And generate is another word for explain. Scientific explanation involves building a model that can generate the world that we experience. And it's, I mean, we didn't have computers when the scientific revolution happened, but the right word for it is we're searching for the algorithm of the universe. Yes, it's like that mathematical scientific understanding is searching for the algorithm that generated the universe, which is just a set of absolutely discrete and precise instructions out of which the universe emerges. But it's no longer looking at what is, it's looking at what generated it.
How it came to be.
How it came to be. And the mathematics, instead of being a static mathematics of just looking at the properties of shapes, becomes a dynamic mathematics of how can we generate these shapes from simpler shapes, and ultimately from, for Newton, from points of mass known as atoms. How can we generate the world from points of mass? And what we're looking for is the mathematics of that generation. That's Newtonian physics.
And it can create a small universe, maybe, in a lab.
Well, people are doing it in their minds, right? And we're doing it now. We're creating small universes in computers, right? They didn't have virtual. Virtual reality is algorithms generating worlds. Mm. Yes? And the parallel now, a lot of philosophers are thinking, well, maybe this is the kind of universe that we live in. Mm. That we're actually some kind of simulation of a universe that's been generated within another universe.
Oh, yeah, Elon Musk believes that.
Well, Dave Chalmers, who's somebody I know, he loves to play with these ideas. He never believes anything. He's too much of a philosopher. But he says it's plausible. All of this is plausible.
And there's this non-locality that you're not there. You're maybe somewhere else, but I'm seeing you.
Well, the final idea of there being locality, if this is a simulated universe, we always think, well, there must be some other space in which it's being generated. But there's no, if it's coming out of a mind, then there's no space. The space is a kind of an illusion that we experience. But that why is it so hard for me even to get through one sentence on there? But I'm trying to get across the idea that modern mathematical science was a complete transformation of this of the Greek understanding, because the Greek understanding had this sense of a reversal, where there are these already pre-existing forms that exist ideally. Plato's ideas, really. Remember the idea of Plato? That the form of the human body is an eternal idea. The form of the horse is an eternal idea. That all of the forms that we find around us, they weren't generated. They were ideas. They were pure creations. And within that, we can explore matter and say, "Oh, look, what are they made of? These forms? Are they made of matter? That's interesting." But it's the forms. And Aristotle saw this too. It's the forms that determine the configuration of the matter, the pre-existent forms. And it's an entirely different ontology. Do you see it would fit, and the world would feel different if you saw it that way. And not just that, there are different levels of form. Celestial form is much higher than earthly form, and the living form is much higher than inanimate form. I was saying earlier about how everything's been leveled. It's been leveled to saying the only true and effective and real form of being is the microphysical stuff. That's what modern science says. It's all microphysical stuff. That's what's really real. That's what generates everything. And it's a complete reversal of this medieval sense that there was substantial forms that form and matter was just doesn't do nothing. It requires the substantial forms, which, and our substantial form is our soul as well. Another way that Aristotle explained it is it's the soul, and the soul, so long as it's present, animates the body and gives the body the form that it has and controls the body's growth. And then when you die, the soul goes and the body disintegrates. Do you see? It explains your experience.
And in Greece, ancient Greece, soul meant some sort of a life force or breath.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. No. And that's the other side of this, is that the substantial forms are what is where motion and movement and energy resides and comes from. The reason that we move is because of our substantial form is an energetic form. It's all soul that moves things. You remember we were talking earlier about why do things fall to the ground? It's because of that's the nature of earthly bodies. They of themselves move towards the ground because they're attracted towards the ground. They're not the playthings of these basic forces that are indifferent to everything. I just want to give you the sense that we didn't. It wasn't just that Newton wrote a book and Galileo looked through a telescope and said, "Oh, look, Jupiter has moons. We must have got that wrong." There was an entire collapse of a whole understanding of a meaningful universe. It was full of meaning, full of soul, full of significance. And there was the prime mover. There was a hierarchy which had an idea of the prime mover, and of course the Greeks had a pantheistic view of there being gods and a psychic realm as well, but they questioned that. The Greeks got to question their own religious views, but they didn't lose the sense of that we live in a living universe.
See, I can understand you, but when I read that.
It's the language, though, Maria.
Yeah, of course.
It's abusive words and language that we're not used to reading.
Just cannot understand that.
So that's a bit like, for me anyway. You know, the intellectual level of
you
writing.
It's quite
difficult.
But then you
realize,
the word is
not like
this. Something like that. They realized we need, but
no, I mean,
they realized that the world was changing and they needed to explain this
Yes, but the explanation of change in the formerly was that it came out of the being or the soul of the thing that was moving. Yeah, so change was explained, but just in a different way.
We're just talking about how difficult it is to read.
Yes.
I thought it was impossible to
read.
Yeah, but,
translation.
All right. See, I'm shocked, you see, because for me, I find Heidegger and Husserl, I think they're difficult because the ideas that they're putting forward are very difficult.
I actually find Heidegger easier to read.
Yeah. But the other thing here is I think the ideas that Hans Jonas is putting forward are quite easy, but I think it's because I've got a lot of background. Do you see? So, and he's assuming background that you don't have. But maybe Heidegger is saying something so new that he can't assume any background.
Yeah, Heidegger writes like he doesn't assume that you're some.
Yeah, this is just
intellectual. Yeah.
Academic stuff at a level that.
Yeah,
scientific theory. Academic.
But do you get the idea behind it? Is extraordinary and quite simple.
Yeah, explain it? No problem. I understand the ideas.
Well, that's the main thing. I do like you to have suffered with a text, and then me to explain it.
Sadistic.
It's not sadistic. It's that actually, if I explain something and it becomes clear and it wasn't clear before, then it matters to you far more than if I just blurred on. That's how I understand it. You know that in a way. You're struggling with the text is your payment. You don't pay for fun, but you do really. You pay by struggling with the text.
Hasn't anybody else written about this? Somebody who's a bit more kind of, you know, pleasant to read.
I like to go back to the person who first expressed it, For me, Jonas is the first person I can find who starts to express this idea of what life is clearly. Now he is expressing it clearly. But do you see how could he couldn't have written a book that said, "All right, first I'm going to give you a course in what it was like to live in medieval Europe," you know, and I'm trying to give that to you as I'm trying to give you the background, even though I didn't live there. Again, it's very interesting. It's like the echo of that time is still in us as well, we don't fully believe in scientific materialism. We don't really regard ourselves as little automatons. No, we still have a sense of something like a soul inhabiting each one of us. It's the idea is still there. So it's not entirely unfamiliar to us. So we're talking about the order of intelligibility being reversed. And the Newtonian science, which we're at the moment we're going through a process where a lot of people are questioning that. I'll let you... Yes. Newtonian science, the science of the 17th century, was reductive in the sense that the whole explanation of the evolution of the universe was to be explained in terms of these elementary particles or atoms or corpuscles. And they were the ultimate being, if you like. They were the ground of what's real here. Them and the laws of their interaction. So without the laws, they just don't do anything. Now, you see, Aristotelian science would have said the same, not so much different, but would have said, no, it's not law, it's the substantial forms. And the substantial forms have essences. The essences are the souls of the substantial forms. And Newtonian science says, forget all of that. We can explain it all much more simply. And this is Occam's razor, if you remember. If you can explain it more simply, that means it's we're going to take it as being true, or more probably true. And the great adventure of scientific materialism, let's not forget this, it started off as a bet, a punt. You know, I want to say it in America, could we possibly explain the entire universe with this incredibly simple scheme of these elementary particles and these basic laws? Could we possibly explain everything that way? And it turns out we can explain a damn hell of a lot. Do you know, our entire technology, right, the magic of mobile phones, of, you know, pressing a button and the garage goes up, of television, of radio, the entire world we live in that hypnotizes us really, has been built entirely on the basis of scientific materialism. There's been no need to think that there's any consciousness or any subjectivity or anything in order to do all of that. Could we possibly do it? Well, do you see? First it was a bet, a crazy idea, and then it just kept rolling on. And as it rolled on, all of these inventions start to arise, because we've discovered electricity and how electricity works. We have electric power. We've discovered radio waves. We've discovered how to transport voice over line, telephone. We've suddenly think how we can get pictures. More recently we discover lasers. Yeah, you know, we've got optic fiber. We've got the internet. Compared to the civilization before, and the alchemists, I mean, who are searching to transform base metal into gold. I mean, in a way, we do know how to transform base metal into gold now. Mm. It takes so too much energy, but we know how to do it. We've got from that world, we are absolutely suffused with magical power, aren't we? I mean, it's just, do you see whenever our culture now touches a former culture, and that there aren't any left hardly, you know, maybe just a few left in the Amazon, but even then you keep seeing somebody pull out a mobile phone. You know, what we've achieved is so extraordinary that the myth of all of the former cultures, the myths of all the former cultures have more or less disappeared, except for some enduring world religions that are still, in some sense, hanging on. We'll see. Well, I won't. I don't want to go into that. But do you get this reversal? Before, the whole universe had to be explained in terms of there being an intelligence that determined how dumb matter was organized. And the whole thing's turned on its head. There's no intelligence. There's just dumb matter and a few laws. And on the basis of that, the whole of the rest of it is generated. And there's no need to postulate any kind of intelligence in order to have achieved that. And you see how God, just the creator God, who was taking care of all of that, is eliminated. What we do is determined by these laws. Yes, our behaviour, the behaviour of the human race, becomes determined by the laws of physics.
It's been generated by.
Yeah, we've been generated too, and even our speech is generated, and our actions and our behaviours and the way we live with life is all generated by this algorithm. I feel like saying it again, a bit scary. A bit.
No.
I know you don't believe it, but a bit. No, all right. No, it doesn't matter because it isn't true. So you know, and I feel at a certain level in all of us, subconsciously, we know it's not true. Even the people who most strongly advocate this, and there are only a few who really say, no, I stake my whole career on this. Even then, when they go home and you know, to their family. I think they have moments where they forget their scientific materialism, just become a different kind of...
My friend, yes, who I always hang out with, he's so like into this, oh, we're just two, we're just this, we're just that, and he's like, he's got like severe depression.
Yeah, but that was just generated by the algorithm, unfortunately. That's what you get when you because I know people like this. They basically they're saying at some level, if you'll forgive this, just be a man. You know, just face it. There is no meaning. You know, the general attitude of someone who takes that extreme position is that if you don't accept it, it's because you're weak. In some sense,
he walks with because he walked for so long with, you know, like slouching his shoulders really like forward.
Yeah,
he started having like a pain in his chest, and he plays the bass, and that's now it's a problem. He's not being able to play because of the pain, as a result of like bending down his back.
Well, you better help him. You better give him a few of the notes from the course.
There is some life support to help. There is a band.
Yeah, maybe that.
I'm stupid, but I haven't got chest pains yet. So, what we get now is a strange alliance, and this is very interesting, between scientific materialism and Christianity itself. There's an interesting connection here, and that a lot of people that I'm reading now are seeing that there's a kind of a drift back, especially in the ecology movement, towards paganism, because there was something happened in Christianity itself. People are now thinking actually materialistic science was a child of Christianity in a bizarre way. You know, that these things are connected together. Or a child of monotheism, of the idea that there's one God, and that God is the good God. Yes, it's a kind of a view that that says all that's good is in the good God, and the good God created the earth, and the earth in itself is a has no real independent being aside from having been created by the great creator God. Independent being is what it had, if we're going way back now, in the pagan times, so that the earth was imbued with earth spirits. Yes, the earth itself was a spiritual entity. The trees had spirits, the rivers, there's a river spirit, there's Pan, there's the nature spirits. The whole of the earth was spiritualized, and different places had spiritual significance. And you can see that in the standing stones and the ley lines and the mythology of old England. Mm. We lived in a spiritualized sense of space, of place.
In the West Country, a lot of people still...
Yes, yeah. Yeah, there's an attempt to try and keep that what was called paganism alive. And Christianity was quite self-consciously set out to expunge that. The earth is just a kind of and the earth almost becomes associated with the devil. It's a kind of just a stage upon which a certain drama of salvation is going to be enacted.
You've been to Glastonbury?
Yes.
It's normal there to believe in weather spirits. It's just so mainstream. I sit in a cafe and people talk about...
Yes, I'm sorry to say that, you know, despite the whole course and everything, when I'm in Glastonbury, I start to feel very uncomfortable about it all. Very uncomfortable. Well, I, the scientist in me starts to emerge. I think there's a lot of loose thinking going on here.
Talking about
Glastonbury.
Oh, it's just a mindless load of crystals and fairies.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Well, I think maybe Maria's expressing something I'm feeling. So when we're talking about paganism, I'm not sure that Glastonbury quite expresses it, because it's a kind of what we're looking for is we're trying to bring two halves, if you like, of our intelligence together, not just to fall back into a kind of
state. I mean, I'm trying to keep an open mind. A friend of mine believes in the healing power of crystals, and I thought, okay, it's possible. So I went along to this place because she wanted to buy some, and I spoke to the person selling the crystals. And I said, okay, so each crystal operates on a different part of the body. And yes, that's right. This one's good for heart problems, this one's good for liver. And I said, oh, that's interesting. How do you know? And I thought she was going to say, well, you know, over the centuries, use as taught, tradition as taught. And she said, oh, no, that knowledge gets channeled through spirit guides. And I said, okay, so, like, how does this work? Spirit guides tell you what the crystal is good for? And she said, yes. And I said, how do you know the spirit guide isn't leading you on? And at which point, you know, the conversation broke down, and I thought, this is no basis. You know, I think...
Well, yeah, but you see, you're giving a lovely expression now of where we're at, right?
Yes.
We're 400 years into being rational.
Yes.
Yes? Mm. And if you like, the new age, is, and a lot of what's happening, is an attempt to reach back to a time before that, where it hasn't been developed. All of that stuff hasn't been developed. You know, there's a sense in which there is something like a light of reason that could shine into this other area, yes, and could be productive if it wasn't. But at the moment, if you like, scientific rationality utterly dismisses that New Age stuff, and the New Age stuff utterly dismisses science. So it becomes kind of, I'm sorry to say this, a kind of irrational gobbledygook, but science is equally dogmatically ignorant in its way. The both are wrong, but both have some right on their side. Do you see? This is the human. It's this falling into opposites all the time.
Mm.
But you know.
I can see that.
Yeah.
But it gets quite bad, Maria, when people. Start to think that if they wear an oxygen suit, that'll cure the cancer. No.
Yes, that was ozone.
Ozone.
Yeah, that was right.
It's you know, people start to believe stuff, and I know of a boy here in Brighton, about 2 or 3 years ago, a young boy with lymphoma, and he didn't want to have treatment. For that, chemotherapy and radiotherapy.
Mm.
And we couldn't do anything to stop that because he was nearly 18, and his father agreed, was influential in that, because they both believed in the power of herbs and things. I don't know, I can't remember some of the cure. And so it's quite sort of difficult to encounter, because I've encountered that quite a number of times in children's and adult oncology, you know, where people think they're going to get a cure from all this other stuff that isn't founded in research and evidence.
But the, you know, you were saying,
sometimes we had a friend who thought mistletoe was going to cure him. And I was quite sort of, well, you know, in my mind, a bit judgmental. And then later down the track, they were studying that in mainstream research. So you have to be difficult, but
Yeah, we really poo-pooed
it. It gets to quite a serious point where people believe in this stuff. But
well, there is a placebo effect as well.
It's like,
at the end of the day,
and crystals. And
yeah.
All the other stuff too, you know, the crystals.
We entirely lack the ontology to make sense of natural and faith healing, and all we entirely lack a kind of basis on which that all. There's a whole set of assumptions, like the spirit guide, like there's a psyche that knows what's going on in your body that can actually inform you what to do. Now that I don't think we can dismiss that.
No.
But it just has no place. You know, what you've got to grade against that is Nicolette and conventional medicine. And there's just no place for that. There's just no room for that in conventional medicine. Because they're two entirely opposed worldviews, you know, at a very deep level.
And the whole opinion of, you know, that the drug companies and the FDA is bad and...
Yeah, no.
I've been in conversation with people going on about the FDA, and I'm thinking,
yes.
For God's sake.
No, the whole of Western medicine is a conspiracy of drug companies for people on the other side, and once again, there's some truth in that, but it's not that. But you know, you ignore the fact that there are thousands of people who are working on medical research who are not influenced at all by the drug companies, whose intent is very sincere. Anyway, we digress, but we're just coming to one of the consequences of this scientific worldview. It had some foundations. You know, these things don't just emerge from nowhere. And one of the foundations is the Christian myth. So in the Christian myth, the world doesn't have a soul. It's only in the Christian myth, it's man, with a capital M being man and woman, that has a soul. And it's the only entity on earth that has freedom, if you like. We have the freedom to err. We have the freedom to go against God. We're created in the image of God, and we have this divine potential in us. But the rest of the earth, we have dominion over the animals, and the rivers, and the streams, and the land, is all desacralized already in the Christian myth. It's just the world, and the idea of Christianity is we have to give up the world. We have to rise above our bestial nature. Mm. Yes, we have to ascend to the spiritual realm. That's our route of salvation. So the world has already been desacralized by Christianity, and that's partly, if you remember, the reason why Descartes' dualism, the dualism said mind and consciousness is only in man, because that's the Christian myth. But you see, it sets up the Great Fall, the Great Fall, because that people did think about that kind of dualism, and it becomes a kind of incomprehensible. So instead of returning back and saying, well, maybe there was a problem further back, we just the idea of the being a kind of a spiritual mental substance dies on the vine, and we're left just by default without having really thought it through with a materialism.
Yes, I saw very interesting. I might put it on the internet if you're interested. There was a talk by some professor from Cambridge who did an exegesis, you know, close reading of the myth of Noah. Now, I happen to know that the myth of Noah came from an earlier myth from Babylon.
And he said that one of the things that gets ignored about this myth is that is what happens after Noah lands on Ararat, after the waters have subsided. Bear in mind, him and his family have supposedly been floating about in this big boat with loads and loads of creatures, keeping them safe, because everything else was being destroyed. Anyway, they all pile out the ark. And what's the first thing that Noah does? He takes some of the animals and he sacrifices them on an altar. Now, this guy said, if you notice, God does not ask him to do this at all. Noah does it of his own. And what is God's reaction? God doesn't say, oh, cheers, thanks for the sacrifice. He says...
He says, you've just destroyed another species.
He says, I will no longer visit the earth with floods, for I see that man is evil in his heart from youth. Mm. In other words, he goes, he says that. He says, what are you doing? You know, and then he says, I'll make a covenant with you. I will make a covenant with all that is flesh in the ark. In other words, not just Noah, but all the animal kingdom as well. So he's saying that if you look closely at the Noah myth, there are two things going on. One is that Noah is trying to make a boundary between humans and animals. And God is trying to bung it back together again and says, no, you're all one. You know, but that's often missed.
Jesus as well, not Jesus, Saint Peter maybe. I remember this in the Bible, that on Sunday you have to rest and you should let your mule rest. That's in the Bible.
Yeah. Well,
so it's quite interesting.
It's ambivalent. Yeah. And it's like scientific materialism took an aspect of Christianity that wasn't there in medieval times. So this more Aristotelian sense of the unity of nature and that all moving things have souls and are animate was prevalent. And a lot of things were going on. One of them being the collapse of, the Holy Roman Empire and the Reformation and Luther and Protestantism and a sort of a Northern European rationality that was a precursor for science, you know. So what we've got, all that Jonas is saying here is the idea that that nature is a kind of a mindless machine. It had some echo in Christianity. Christianity laid the ground for this. Because we have a God who created nature and set the law. The law in terms of how nature is. Nature itself has no freedom. And that's how we regard the suffering of animals is another question. But nature itself has no spirit, if you like. It doesn't have a spiritual potential in it. Only man has the spiritual potential in it. So there's an absolute dividing line between man, and then we've got the devils and the angels and all the supernatural beings between man and God. But beneath man is just world. And it's already a flat, created other realm that is something that we're destined in a way to leave behind us. Paradise is not on earth. Whereas for a more pagan view is that there is this earthly paradise that we're living in now. So do you see this ability to the world, it was already set up as a realm of unimportance, something that could be explained entirely mechanistically. And the next thing is this principle of inertia sounds like a little thing, right? But basically, what the principle of inertia says, again, thinking that there is a God, is that in the moment of creation, the entire universe was given a certain amount of energy, a fixed amount of energy, and everything everything is in movement from the very beginning and continues in movement unless it's changed by being impinging on something else. But that's, if you like, that set, that stock of movement is not emerging from the soul of a being. It's not to be explained in terms of I moved my leg because I had the urge to move it. It's entirely explicable in terms of this already, and this is still in physics, in the conservation of energy. The universe just has this a certain amount of energy, although I know that with dark matter and dark energy, people are wondering about that. It's coming into question now. But for all of the past before that, there was no need anymore to explain why things move. Things don't move because they're alive, because they've got living energy in them. Things move because of inertia, because of force, because of inanimate physical energy is the cause of movement. And do you see that this is deeply in us? It's in our medical science. You know, why does your arm move? Well, it's to do with electrochemical signals originating in the brain, moving down to your muscles, and then we look at the mechanism of why the muscles move. There's no living vital energy causing your muscles to move. It's all entirely electrochemical.
But it's a different question, isn't it? It's how. How and why are two different questions.
Agreed. But we're just still in this transition from the idea of there being some kind of that the cause of movement was coming out of the being of the thing that was moving.
Maybe science, materialistic science, says if you can explain the how, you don't need to look at the why.
Well, we're going to just a bit more. Materialistic science is saying, well, we are explaining things from the bottom up, so there isn't any why. There is no why. You've just got the basic conditions, the algorithm, and everything else flows from that.
But they're always looking for a why in biology, aren't they? Like, why do creatures do this or that? And then they explain it because of something in the environment or...
But all of these explanations in this style of science will eventually, and we're going to come to this, reduce down to the laws of physics. And you could say, I'm giving you an explanation at this level, or the level of bodies, and I can give you an explanation that says body X does Y, and that causes body Z to do K. And I can give you a cause and effect at that level, but if you drill into that further, you'll say, well, why did body X do what it does? And you'll go into how its functioning of its organs and its muscles. And then if you say, well, why did the muscles do what they do? And you get down to the electrochemical basis of it all. Do you see that actually, the lecture, if we get through, and if you've done your reading of Jonas, he explains all of this. Yes, that there isn't... The ultimate why is exactly this. It's the why is explicable in terms of the laws of physics operating on these elementary units. And to ask for a why beyond that, there's no further why. Those are the axioms that we put in place to begin with. You don't ask, you can't ask behind the axioms. So nature is inanimate. That means it's not living. It's not moving because it's alive. It's the same physical force or energy that's present in inertia in when you throw a rock that's moving your arm. There's no distinction. It's absolute flattening of being.
That is in some ways why we are destroying the Earth, because we don't believe that is important.
Yes, we just, in a certain sense, our economic behaviour is driven by a certain rationality, which is to do with efficiency and profit making. And it doesn't, because we've lost any sense of the sacredness of nature. Nature is a resource. If we came to value nature more, that would just, it would still be just be a resource. It's just its valuation has gone up, and that's sort of what's happening. We aren't changing our kind of essentially rationalistic selfishness. We're just saying, oh God, I really do value the trees. and the air being clean. We hadn't valued them properly. Maybe we need to change our system of valuation, but it's not a really fundamental change. It's not saying nature is sacred. There are levels of being here. It's just saying, are we under our current form of economic organisation is going to fall apart, which is bad. Why is it bad? Well, because we're Darwinistic creatures and we want to survive.
Older people, like in the Mediterranean countries, they kind of believe that the bread dough is alive, and they make a cross on it, and they just like treat it
yeah,
as
yeah.
sick, and
yes.
it acts as if it's alive.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's the line between what is alive and what is dead is just culturally influential.
Well, but you see, the ultimate myth that we're living under is sort of saying that, we've got a concept of what it means to be alive, but it's not intrinsically in the universe itself. It's something. It's a distinction that we make. Because what the universe is, as far as this is what Jonas is saying, as far as this mathematical God is concerned, the objective view of mathematical physics, nothing's really alive. That's just a certain interpretation we put on it.
Like a virus doesn't.
Actually, science doesn't say nothing's alive. Science says, well, what you mean by alive is this, but. Everything's just made out of material stuff. There isn't any special different form of being or different form of existence that distinguishes the stuff in you from the stuff in the floor.
In biology, they somehow put some kind of like, in order for something to be a living creature, it should be able to metabolize, maybe.
Well, we're getting to that.
I was just thinking, I think there's more to it than just intellectual changes of view. I mean, it strikes me that nature is something that human beings have always been extremely scared of. I mean, because, you know, you think about what nature does to you. And
yes.
You know, it's not a pretty thing at all.
Well, we're still scared of it, aren't we?
We are, but I'm saying
climate change.
In the past, we kind of go, oh yeah, we can deal with this by appeasing the gods of nature and, you know, bringing them presents and things like that. And then it changes into kind of like, well, you know, we can we can deal with it by living inside nature and seeing ourselves as part of it and understanding it by living with it, and, you know, the animals are, you know, this, that and the other. And then gradually we start to deal with it in a different way. We deal with it by saying, oh, no, it's all that stuff over there. It's just material stuff. It's, you know... And we can control it. We can control nature.
Yes.
You know, that's how we deal with our fear. But I think ultimately what's at the bottom of it all is fear.
Yes.
We are frightened.
There was a... part of this, the enormous appeal of science was just what you said. It starts to extend our control of the natural world by our understanding mathematically the structure of how it behaves. As soon as we saw more deeply into this mathematical aspect, and we have to say that, it's not fictitious. We can look into the mathematical aspects of how nature behaves. The further we see, the more we can control it. And at the time, in the 17th century, we had a sense that nature was a greater power than we are, but in that period of time, we've I don't know if we've quite reversed it. We've just created global problems with nature rather than local ones, because nature still looms threateningly over us. With climate change and with the destruction of the species, it's still a power that we haven't controlled, not really. We've controlled it locally and created global problems. So we're still attempting to control nature in a bizarre way with our concern of climate change. Our idea is that we've got to control the climate. Our control isn't good enough. Finally, that would be the most terrible thing, wouldn't it? I can see it now. I just look up what the weather's going to be on Friday. Oh yeah, they're going to turn the rain on at midnight. Yeah, and we're going to rain because the farmers have negotiated this. Yeah, they're going to turn the rain on at midnight and it's going to stop at 2:10 in the morning. Right? Could we like it to rain at night? And then we're going to have a sunny morning. Yeah, but we don't think so overheat, so the clouds going to be coming on at 12:15. Yeah, and basically, you have to pay to get the right weather. You know, so different parts of the economy make bids for the weather that they want in the certain area. You know, and that's the idea, right? That's where we're heading. If we can do it, we'd do it, wouldn't we? We wouldn't not do that, would we? Not the way we're living now.
Yeah. Well, people, would you want to be immortal if you could do it? Similar sort of question, isn't it?
Well, seemingly immortal, I think, is the best we're going to get. But we won't go into that. But you've got the idea that nature becomes mindless and inanimate, but that was already foreshadowed with this Christian view of the world. So it didn't just pop out. Everything has to have a deep ground laid for it before it catches. You see, it seems to catch in the psyche. Do you know, it's not as if anybody stood up on a pulpit and said, this is the way we're going to think of things from now on. It all happens in the background. It's quite remarkable. So, I think I do have to open the window. I'm still not getting in.
Are you warm enough now?
Yes.
It's central, isn't it? We can't turn it.
I've switched those two off. I think maybe that one's still on, but it's something's on. So one of the things that Hans Jonas is doing now in his reading, he's saying, well, what does an organism look like when viewed this way, when viewed by what we would call Newtonian and then Darwinian science. So, and I'd if you can remember back to there are two things. David Eagleman, you remember David Eagleman saying, "What's really real? What's really real is all that electromagnetic radiation. There's no colour, there's no sound." You remember? And you might remember Heidegger's talking about the blossoming tree and saying, is that in your brain? And if you looked in the brain, what would you see? Something like this, a void mostly crisscrossed by the geometry of forces that emanate from the insular foci of localized elementary being. Now that's, maybe you find that a pretty horrible sentence, but the world of particle physics has moved on since then. It's considered to be a broiling mass of quantum energy, but something, it hasn't essentially changed. That was the model of the atomic particles and the forces that are act between them, and the idea that these are just localized points of force in what's largely a total void, and that what materialistic science is saying is that everything that happens here, even if we can't do it because it's too complex to do, essentially and in principle is determined by the interactions of these elementary units, and we do have a very good idea about the laws that these elementary units observe, and that everything else that happens here is generated out of those, the interactions of those elementary units. And because of that, that's the only place where there's real cause and effect, where there may be even a level below that, and that's what quantum mechanics has come to think, right, that there's a level below the atomic where something else even stranger is going on. But if we just stay with this atomic molecular level, the idea, the belief, if you like, it is a belief of physical science, is that the only truly effective cause and effect oomph occurs there. There isn't, and this is quite important, there isn't some higher level being, like your being, the being of your body, that can influence in any way what's going on with these elementary particles and the laws that they observe. And as soon as you accept that picture, then the idea that you have anything like free will is the idea that it's really free, that your decision determines how matter behaves, is not true. It's matter and the laws of its interaction that determines how you behave. That's what the inversion means.
But even people like Sartre, who believe in free will, say that everybody's got something that's called facticity, which means that you are bounded, your freedom is bounded by your material self. So you can't just suddenly fly because you haven't got wings and, you know, things like that. There is a limit to your freedom that is the limit of you being who you are in a particular time and location and configuration. We haven't got complete freedom because we have got a body.
Yes, but what this is saying is that if you have any sense whatsoever that you're free to decide anything in this life, that is an illusion. It's quite definite. You've got to get this. It's just pure reasoning. If everything at the atomic and subatomic level is determined by the laws of physics, then all of the aggregations of that material, like your body, is absolutely determined by the interactions of the little parts.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So when you think that you're deciding to do something, all that's happening are the little elementary units inside your body are just following the laws of physics, and there was absolutely no possibility of you doing anything different to what you did do, because the laws of physics determined what you did do.
No.
So you're saying I don't believe that.
No.
That's fair enough. I'm not saying believe that, Maria.
No, you're saying
I'm
that's
saying
not
this
the
is this
the
is
extreme
a
di- form of
it's not an extreme form. It's a consequence of, if as a physicist you believe that the laws of physics are fixed, then this is a deductive consequence of that.
Right.
It's not an opinion. It's, you know, you've got your axiom. Your axiom is that the laws of physics are fixed. They can't be interfered with from some higher level system like you. Then your idea that your behaviour in any way you could have done it differently is false.
But I still don't get it, because, I mean, if I drop the glasses on the table, I can't cause them not to fall. No, I can't affect matter in that sense.
No, we're talking about the common or garden idea of free will, which is, says, I'm in the supermarket, shall I get the mozzarella or the halloumi? I don't know. Let me think about it. And in your thinking about it, you think that you are free to choose between one or the other.
Mm.
And that what this is saying is absolutely not. The fact that you're going to choose the halloumi is already determined by the connection strengths of the synapses in your brain.
Really?
Really.
That's what they say.
Well, it's not what they say. It's not an opinion. You're not getting this.
No.
It's a deductive consequence of accepting that the laws of physics are inviolable. Inviolable.
Okay. I'll just have to.
But no, I'm not asking you to accept it, Maria. I'm asking you
to say
that it's a matter of understanding that that's what that means, to think that way. Now, philosophers have thought about this, have said, yeah, there is free will, but it's not, it's only free in quotes. Free in quotes means it was completely possible for you to have bought the mozzarella and not the halloumi. That decision wasn't determined from the outside, but it was determined by the structure of your brain. So the whole process of deliberation that you were going was the unfolding of an algorithm, and the unfolding of the algorithm is ultimately determined by the laws of physics. It's not an extreme view. If you disagree with that view, and a lot of people think about this, then you're going to have to propose some kind of, and this is what they like to say, some kind of spooky spirit that's going to interfere with the laws of physics and make you behave in a way that in some sense goes against the laws of physics. And yes,
depression. They explain, no, it's because there was not enough magnesium in your brain.
Some chemicals.
Then they define the depression like something
entirely
chemical.
But it, even then, you could say, no, your depression is partly to do with a traumatic event that happened to you that changes the structure of your brain. Physically change the structure of your brain. Everything can be explained. Remarkable thing here is, this is what he's saying about the mathematical God, everything that we observe here, that we understand in a certain way, can be explained at this ultimate physical level, can be deduced from. The thing that is missing is, of course, nobody can actually do that deduction because it's just too complex. Yes, because you're talking about uncountable trillions of subatomic particles all interacting in such a way that they can never be observed. It's just a hypothesis, but this is the hypothesis of materialistic science, and it's the background hypothesis of our culture, even though at the same time we believe we have free will. And another way to put it is, you can choose between two things, but you can't choose what you choose. Here's a choice before me. I could either go A or I could either go B. I choose to go A, but you can't choose to have chosen that. That was already determined. It was determined by the entire past and how it structured your brain and how it gave you a faint favouring towards path A over path B. The fact that you favoured A over B, the fact you had to go through a whole process of deliberation is also perfectly mechanical, because the process of deliberation is actually changing the structure of your brain in quite a mechanical way. So that finally, after the process of deliberation has mechanically changed the structure of your brain, you choose A. And I mean, I have the advantage here of being a computer scientist. It's not gobbledygook for me. I can write you a program that makes decisions, just like we do. And it's just a bunch of code, all fixed in advance and utterly predictable. Even though events that are occurring in time change the structure of the code, so it's not like you've got a fixed program that's the same for all time. The kind of program that our brain runs is changing all the time, but the way in which it changes is fixed by what? Well, you know, by the DNA, by evolution. You know, the entire thing is this extraordinary stream of explanation that it covers the entire universe. That's what we're saying. It covers every event. I'd love you to just see the full extent of that idea. It's an incredible idea. It's an incredible idea. We're odd creatures to have come up with that idea. Very odd indeed, and for it to have become I mean, this is a seriously funded idea. It's not just a kooky idea. Billions and billions and trillions of dollars and pounds and euros are spent financing research and development that are entirely predicated on this understanding of the universe. As is the rationality of the business world. Even if it takes account of human behaviours. It's not, you don't have to think in terms of microphysical particles to be following this kind of reasoning. And hopefully we're going to get to the point in the lecture where this becomes clear, which is...
But one question.
Yes.
For example, in finance, they try to predict how it's working the stock market.
Yes.
But then they create a program to...
Yes.
Predict, like a simulation.
Yes.
But at the end, it's the same program that create the reality, because then people start to follow the program, and then obviously the reality will be like the program, because they are following.
Yes, the what you're describing is feedback, because this is another area where people that I supervise doing research, a lot of them think I'm going to make a fortune because I do machine learning. What you're describing is that the very program that you build that from past evidence successfully predicts what to do is going to change the behavior of the stock market. As soon as you start trading with it, it's a different stock market. So it's the premises on which it works has changed, and it won't work again in the right way. And if it isn't at all successful, then lots of other people will copy it, and then you get a new market. Do you see? So you need a higher level kind of machine intelligence that recognizes that there's nothing predictable from the past. And there's accepted theory that because of that, the stock market is a kind of random walk, and the only way to really make money on the stock market is in short-term trading. But because it hasn't. Because you can predict short term because the market hasn't caught up to the fact it's changed. But as soon as it does, then it's unpredictable again.
And also in some ways...
Unless you've got insider knowledge, of course.
In some ways, they know what will happen because, already, for example, in America in 2008 and before 2008, they started to sell a mortgage that they knew were... bad mortgage,
yeah,
and then some people were building new financial products.
Yes,
with something that was not good. Then they knew this is going to explode finally because it's based on something that is not good.
So just so you can see, you can only predict on the data that is put into you. Yes, and if you just try and predict the stock market on the basis of information about the stock market, you've only got partial knowledge. Once you start expanding out and you realise, oh, this was happening in the economy, you've got a bit broader knowledge. And if you expand out, again, in principle, right down to the microphysical level, then the stock market becomes predictable then. Because you know about what every single individual is doing, what they're thinking, how they're going to behave, how they're going to trade. And if you had a program like that, that would be God's program, except for quantum effects. So that quantum effects make the entire system inherently unpredictable. But that still doesn't break you out of the mathematical, rational understanding that everything is determined at this lowest level. It's just that some things at that lowest level are random. There's nothing in there that says that has any room for our concept of free will. And if you want to have something like free will, you need to have an entirely different ontology, an entirely different understanding of being, which we don't have. So we basically get along with entirely conflictual levels of understanding about what's going on here. We're a kind of, as a culture, we're schizophrenic. Yeah, because we do believe in free will. We believe in a whole lot of stuff that contradicts our science.
One question: in some ways, for example, in logic, that is based in Boolean logic, then was a theory, and then was a reality. Because it's zero of one, and then there was like the technology, the computer, electricity, not electricity, zero of one. But then they started to realize that it's not working really, and they started to create the fuzzy logic.
Yeah.
And then now they are creating they need a technology to manage this that is not the 0-1 technology, is not the energy, not the energy.
But just let me say, as a computer scientist,
mm-hmm.
that fuzzy logic is implemented on a Boolean logic machine.
Mm.
So that didn't get rid of the Boolean logic. It's just you can use Boolean logic to implement fuzzy logic. So fuzzy logic is just a higher level logic. The Boolean nature of computing is still it's to do with being discrete, or
mm-hmm.
it's ultimately still discrete.
But they realize that with this technology, they can manage very well this logic. They need, for example, the quantum mechanics, because the quantum mechanics works more with more than two scenarios.
Yes.
With
superpositions. Uh-huh. Yes. But we have to come back, because any minute
reality.
Now. This isn't quite reality either, is it? But what we're coming to an important part of the lecture here. He's saying, within this, metabolism is discernible, right? And metabolism is very interesting.
It's not magical, is it?
It's not magical.
No.
And as far as physical science is concerned, there's nothing interesting about metabolism at all, except it's the complexity of it. The complexity of it's interesting. Let me read this out. In this mode of being, the material parts of which the organism consists at a given instant are only temporary, passing contents whose joint material identity does not coincide with the identity of the whole which they enter and leave, and which sustains its identity by the very act of foreign matter passing through its spatial system, the living form. Now, the thing being here, when we mentioned this at the end of the last lecture, we're looking at, in our mind's eye, if you like, at a single living cell, say a bacterium, and if we look at it as a material entity and we look at the elementary units that make it up, then what's happening in that cell is there's a continual inflowing and outflowing of material elementary units. Continual, although, unless you read Jonas carefully, excepting the DNA. He didn't mention that in the DNA is interesting. So within a living cell, the DNA in the nucleus of the cell actually remains materially static. But everything else in the cell is continuously being transformed. And if you look at the trajectory of an individual elementary unit, an atom, let's say, it will enter the cell and leave the cell during the lifetime of the cell. And all of the material in the cell, except for the DNA, will have entered at a certain time and have left at another time. So the cell is in a continual process of what we would call regeneration. It's actually continuously enacting chemical reactions that are producing proteins that actually make up the body of the cell. And it's also engaged in chemical reactions that are continuously replacing the cell membrane. and all of the RNA that's synthesizing the proteins is the RNA itself is continuously being synthesized itself from within the cell. So the cell is synthesizing all of the molecular structures that make up the cell in this continuous cyclical process of recreating itself. And it lives. Its being alive is this process of its self recreation. And we say that the cell has an identity, that it's a living being. Now, ordinarily, if we've got a rock, we would say that its living being corresponds with the matter in it. Yes? Although, you know, things fall on the surface and other things fall off. There's a little bit of movement of the matter in a rock. But basically, the rock's identity coincides with its material identity. Remembering that physical science says what is material is what's really real. So if we look at a living cell, and if we say that what's material is what's really real, you would say, oh, well, the cell isn't really real. What's really real is all the stuff going in and out of the cell, and our idea that the cell has an identity over time just ain't true from that physical, materialistic science perspective. Yes? But of course, at a certain level, it is true. And science recognizes that as well. We're coming to that. But we want to see that this metabolic exchange of matter with the environment, because that whole process of the cell's living life is described as its metabolic life. It's the process of metabolic exchange. It's not like the way a car engine works. It's not as if fuel goes in and exhaust gases come out. See, that when the fuel goes in a car and exhaust gases come out, there's a central physical structure that is the car's engine that remains the same. If the car was like a living cell, then the engine itself would be continually dematerializing itself and recreating itself. All the pistons, all the piston rods, the crankshaft, would be continuously disintegrating and then reassembling itself over and over and over. The entire thing would be a complete process of fluid change, whereas that's not like that. So the kinds of machines that we've built are materially static, like the apple. This is important in terms of recognizing the difference between ourselves and a computer. Because the cells that make up our brain are living cells as well, the neurons. And they're interesting in themselves as well, in that they, most of them, are with you your whole life. But that doesn't mean that they're materially static. They're still engaged in this process of metabolic recreation every moment. So a metabolizing system is not like our conventional idea of a machine. And this is where...
Jan's saying that. Jan's saying that.
Yes.
That's what he's saying.
Yes, it is. But I'd just like to expand that a little bit. So there's a lot of people who are saying, well, the difference between that we draw the line, a machine is something that is materially static, and a living system is something that is continuously changing. But I would still say that what's happened now is that because of our studying of what it means to be a living cell, what's really happened is our idea of what it means to be a machine has expanded. We now really, biological science sees the living cell as a new kind of machine, a machine that we never dreamt of before, but one that we're pretty interested in building machines like that as well.
This is system theory.
Yes, this is system theory. So general systems theory preceded what Hans Jonas had to say, and he probably got something from general systems theory. Bertalanffy, I think, I can't pronounce his name, but he was an Austrian scientists first proposed general systems theory, which became cybernetics after the war. And now the book with Luisi and Fritjof Capra that I gave you the reading from is a modern account of the rebirth, if you like, of systems thinking that's happening in this century. So systems thinking, there are two forms of it. Systems thinking can carry on entirely within the umbrella of materialistic science, or systems thinking can propose that our very ontology of materialism is wrong. So it's not as if systems thinking has overthrown our mathematical science. Far from it. It's in fact the latest development of mathematical science, with the development of chaos theory, as you remember, and fractals, and there's a whole new mathematics to describe the mathematical structure of systems, very much akin to the development of calculus to describe the evolution of physical systems. There's a new mathematics that describe the behaviour of complex non-linear systems. I'm just digressing there a little bit, because a lot of people think that systems thinking is a kind of a total revolution and all of science has changed. But it's a quite a natural evolution of the way that science already thinks.
But science has the concept of synergy?
Well, there's...
And teleological?
Yes.
Maybe teleological, yes, but synergy, I think, not a lot.
The one thing that systems thinking is emphasising is that you have to understand the whole. Just understanding the parts doesn't give you an understanding of the whole. And we're going to, I think, that's something about metabolism I've thought a lot about this and I've read a lot about this, and it's a very fine line. An awful lot of people who are thinking that systems thinking is a complete revolution in science, I think, are mistaken. A complete revolution in science will only occur, and this maybe is a deep message of this course, if we get a new understanding of being. But I jump ahead in saying that.
The problem is that for some group of people, system theory is everything.
Yes, it gets the yeah.
System engineers.
And of course, I mean, I had to teach systems theory at Sussex, and I was endeavouring to teach Hans Jonas to the master's students studying computing, but they didn't. They weren't as receptive as you are. Not that they were arguing with me, but they weren't. They were saying, "Well, we just came here because we want to write algorithms and get a good job. You know, we didn't come here to study philosophy." And I was saying, "No, it's important. Yeah, it's important. These ideas are important." All right, let's have a break. Yes, yeah, it is time.
Lunchtime.